to take the roll.
Representative Koppelman.
Here.
Representative Honorman. Representative Bowe. Representative Banning. Representative Devlin.
Here.
Representative Frenzbar.
Here.
Representative Munson. Representative Owens.
Here.
Representative Schatz. I saw him here. Representative Thorson. Senator Andrus.
Here.
Senator Heckerman.
Here.
Senator Hoog.
Here.
Senator Klein. Senator City.
Here.
That is a quorum, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Well, we apologize to those of you who have been waiting. Thank you for your patience. We just got off the floor in the House, and I suspect the Senate probably as well. So appreciate everybody coming and taking time. In the middle of the session, this is always a little bit of a dilemma for us because the Administrative Rules Committee is kind of an odd animal. It's not a standing committee during the legislative session. It's also not an interim committee. It's a statutory committee. So by law, we are required to meet most of the time we use in the interim, but we're required to meet quarterly, which also entails a meeting during the legislative session. So this is it. And we're glad to have you all here, and our quorum is swelling by the moment here with more folks coming in. So with that, the first item on our agenda is the consideration of the minutes from the December 12th meeting. We have a motion for approval. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved by Representative Andrus, seconded by Representative Heckerman. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Minutes are approved. Next item is a presentation by the Commissioner of Agriculture regarding the rules, April 2013 rules. And the Commissioner looks different than the last time I saw him, but welcome. It normally works, but we can go ahead and start, can't we, John? You don't need them. Yeah. Go ahead. We'll get it looked at.
And members of the Administrative Rules Committee, my name is Jim Gray. I'm the Pesticide and Fertilizer Division Director with the North Dakota Department of Agriculture.
Excuse me. Thank you.
Proposed changes to Title VII of the Administrative Code as they pertain to dairy meat and hydrous ammonia rules. I'll tell you that the Legislative Council also provided a list of questions to us in email on March 5th. Answer to those questions are attached to my testimony as well. If I could, I'd like to go through briefly what the rule changes were.
Thank you.
The proposed changes to the dairy rules, found on page 3 of your packet, under Chapter 703.214, are to address a change in vehicle requirements. The rule changes the required temperature at which dairy products must be transported from 41 degrees to 45 degrees. The department also proposed changes to 3 chapters of the anhydrous ammonia rule under Article 7-12. These are found pages 4 through 17 in your packet. Legislation in the 62nd Legislative Assembly transfers inspection authority for anhydrous ammonia facilities from the Insurance Department to the Agriculture Commissioner. Therefore, Chapter 7-1201 of the Administrative Code was amended to remove any reference to the Insurance Commissioner or Chief Boiler Inspector and replace those references with the Agriculture Commissioner. The 62nd Legislative Assembly also enacted a new chapter of the Century Code to give the Agriculture Commissioner authority to inspect risk management plans of agricultural anhydrous ammonia facilities in the state of Iraq. This is a delegated program from the U.S. EPA. Chapter 7-1203 of the code was created so the Ag Department can adopt those federal regulations by reference. That's found on page 21 of your packet. And last, the department is proposing to repeal Chapter 7-12-02. That's on pages 18 through 20 of your packet. Those rules have established critical methamphetamine use zones and required locks on anhydrous ammonia nurse tanks in Williams and McKenzie County. That chapter is being repealed at the suggestion of the Attorney General's office. The meat and poultry inspection rules in Chapter 7-1301 are being changed as well to adopt federal meat inspection regulations. It is a federal requirement for all state programs to be equal to those federal requirements. The proposed rules adopt the federal regulations as of December 1st, 2012. So we're adopting the most current federal regulations. So Chairman Koppelman and members, I thank you for this opportunity to discuss recent administrative rule changes by the Agriculture Commissioner. I provided written answers to the specific questions posed by Mr. Walstead in his March 5th email as well in the packet, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I also have representatives from our meat inspection program and our dairy program here if folks have specific questions on those rule changes.
Very good. Questions for Mr. Gray? Representative Franzloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gray, I'm interested in finding out why the change in temperatures in the transportation of meat. It's on page 3 of the, from 41 to 45 degrees.
Representative Franzloff, with your permission, I have Wayne Carlson. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Wayne Carlson. I'm the dairy director for the state of North Dakota. Several years ago, I changed all the dairy regulations, and I made a change in the current law to reduce the temperature that milk and milk products were distributed from 45 to 41. That 41 degree temperature matched the code that the health department and all retailers use or require in the retail counters. And it all made common sense for me to say that our rules were similar to that, because you're transporting milk, it should be the same temperature as it is in the retail counter. I thought that made common sense until I got threatened by the National Milk Organization, said they'd be prohibiting interstate transportation of milk products because all other states are at 45 degrees. So I said, next time that we do a rule change, I will change it back, and I'm here to do that so that the state does not get sued on that part of it. So, most of the trucks are at 41 degrees anyway. We monitor temperatures and do inspections. So it really doesn't affect either way, but to be same with federal law, we're moving it back to 45 degrees, and I apologize for the time it takes for you guys to do this, but I thought it was better that we do follow the state ship on the way.
And here we all thought people just wanted a little warmer milk. It's further questions. Representative Matterin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a quick question on the repealing of the locks on anhydrous ammonia tanks in Williams and the county that the suggesting Attorney General. Can you elaborate a little more why we're repealing that, please?
Yes, Representative and members. When we looked at amending the anhydrous ammonia chapter,
we approached the Attorney General. The feedback we received from them is that the restrictions on pseudoephedrine has really made a noticeable decrease in our methamphetamine, and they were curbing the problem there. I also visited with county sheriffs in those two counties, and they expressed some difficulty with the field enforcement of those restrictions, and their advice was to either make it statewide or to strike it for just those two counties.
What was the rule on that telephone?
Yeah, further questions for Mr. Gray? So on that point, Mr. Gray, basically we're just saying that the pseudo offender changes have dealt with the problem enough that the anhydrous careful monitoring is no longer necessary.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is accurate.
All right. So no further
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Gray, I'm just wondering then why we don't just repeal this statewide. Why would we require other counties to have locks still?
Senator City and members, other counties do not require locks. That rule had only required locks in those two specific counties.
All right, seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Gray, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any further testimony from the Ag Department? That takes care of it. All right. We'll move on to our next item, which is the Attorney General and state lottery rules.
Need one more copy, do we?
No, we're fine, I think. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Administrative Rules Committee, my name is Randy Miller. I'm the Director of the North Dakota Lottery Division of the Office of Attorney General, and I'm here today to provide the information describing the process that the lottery followed in adopting the published rules to be published in the 2013 supplement. These rule updates are required to be in compliance with the Multi-State Lottery Association's game rules. So, Mr. Chairman, unless you'd like to proceed differently, I'll answer the questions if that's how you'd like to move forward with this.
That's fine.
Okay. First of all, the rules do not result from statutory changes made by a legislative assembly.
And you can summarize if you'd like. You don't have to read it word for word.
Okay.
If you just want to.
There really isn't anything until we get down into the actual changes. Everything else is fairly standard from the first three questions there. We get into question four, was written in oral comments. That's on page two of the handout, or the back side of the handout there. We did have a few comments that were submitted. The first three comments you can see in the middle of page two there are related to correcting an error in the odds for three of the prize levels. And it would be on page 25 and 26 of the rules that were provided through Legislative Council. The corrections were typographical errors, and the odds have been corrected to reflect the Multi-State Lottery Association's game rules, so it's just being being consistent with what's happening with the Multi-State Lottery. The other comment we had was include language when a resident winner does not have a Social Security number. That's at the bottom of page two, and thereby requiring a higher standard than federal withholding tax. On the top of page three of the handout, the commission took no action on that. The Lottery Advisory Commission, that is, took no action on this one. The change was not necessary. Current language in the rules reduces the gross grand prize by the required federal and state withholding taxes. Therefore, the lottery is following the IRS guidelines in the requirements of withholding tax. The corrected odds, as I noted on the first comments, those were approved by the Lottery Advisory Commission and submitted to a final approval to Attorney General Stengel as well. And so those comments were reflected in the revised, the last final revision here that, as I said, noting from your handouts on page 25 and 26. Other than that, again, the purpose of the proposed amendments is update the rules effective May 12th, so they were not emergency rules. They will be effective May 12th. It was required by, the Multi-State Lottery Association. And the, as we noted, the rules were not on page 3 there, or page 4, or page 3 of the handout. The rules were not adopted as emergency rules. And so if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer specifically regarding the rules, but they are, as I said, straightforward in regards to following the Multi-State Lottery Association requirements.
Questions for Mr. Miller?
Randy, when you do this, Muscle, I didn't realize Muscle also controlled the odds. I suppose they do. Do they change that frequently? Is this common?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, depending on which game group it is, there's the directors are the make up the game group. Multi-state lottery oversees that, but the vote is actually taken by directors of the lottery, and then it needs to pass the majority vote, more than two-thirds actually, to move forward with any changes, in particular as this one here with the odds change, that is.
Very good. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you
for your testimony. And I think we are just about exactly on time. Do we have Department of Financial Institutions here? We do. We've caught up, members of the committee. And welcome, Senator Klein. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Entringer. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Financial Institutions. And I will skip to the bottom of page 3 and review the rules for you, and then jump around, I guess, if needed. So as far as the first rule, Chapter 130402 relates to the regulation of collection agency. The majority of the changes within this chapter relate to definitions, and the rules were being amended to add definitions for debtor and person and modify the term debt collector. Throughout the chapter, the term claim is replaced with debt, and the term consumer is replaced with debtor. Purpose of those changes are to make the rules consistent with statute, and the amendment also removes references to the issuance of debt collector identification cards since they are no longer issued by the department. Finally, the amendment clarifies the rule on threatening legal action, providing that a collector may not threaten legal action unless the action is both lawful and the collector is entitled to bring such action and the collector intends on bringing the action. Jump back, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right, to bottom of page 2 regarding comments. There were no comments at our public hearing. However, we did receive two comment letters, and they both related to collection agencies. The first was in the form of an email from Kim Granfer, and it addressed Section 130402.05, subsection 5 of the proposed rules, and pointed out that the term imply was overly vague. As a result of reviewing the comments, we removed the words or imply in order to address their remarks.
And where is that in the rule? I'm sorry.
That would be in 04.02.05.
That's on page 34. Okay.
Yep. And it was in subsection 5 of there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The second comment was in the form of a November 19th letter from the American Financial Services Association. concerning the definition of debt collector as found under Section 1304 or 201 of the proposed rule amendments. Specifically, the commenter took exception with the fact that the North Dakota law did not exempt from licensure entities collecting debt associated with an affiliated company. Upon reviewing the comment, it was my conclusion that any changes associated with exemptions from licensure were better suited for the legislative process, and I also noted that one reason for rule change was to incorporate the parameters of licensure under the statute. Okay, I'll skip back to page 4. And Chapter 1305.01 relates to the regulation of money brokers. This section is being amended to remove disclosure requirements, which are already addressed under federal law. Additionally, the filing of annual reports to the department is section is being repealed because we already received the information contained within the annual report through the quarterly call reports submitted through the nationwide mortgage licensing system. Chapter 1306.01 relates to the regulation of deferred presentment service providers or payday lenders. Changes in this section relate to the statewide transactional database maintained by the department to monitor the amount of loans taken by each borrower in North Dakota. Currently, we contract with a vendor named Veritech to administer the database. The purpose of tracking this information is to ensure that borrowers do not exceed the aggregate $600 statutory limit on payday loans. Various amendments contained in this chapter address the need for updated terminology relating to both the database and the electronic transactions currently used to replace paper checks. The amendments to this chapter also remove the need for licensees to file reports with the commissioner based on the fact that this information is being captured through the database. Additionally, the period of time for a deferred presentment instrument must be presented is being increased from 45 to 60 days to create consistency with the statute. The written agreement section of the chapter is repealed because these requirements were brought into statute in the 2011 session. Finally, this chapter is being amended in order to address various matters relating to the administration of the database, transactions conducted on the database, and fees associated with usage of the database. Rules are being proposed under 1308.12, subsection 4 of the Century Code, which provides the commissioner shall adopt rules governing the creation, structure, and use of the database. Chapter 1307.01 relates to the regulation of money transmitters, and the only change proposed to this chapter is the creation of a definition for past due or doubtful of collection, which is in the statute, and that this amendment is based on a specific question which came up during an examination of a money transmitter. Chapter 1308.01 relates to the regulation of mortgage loan originators, and the only change proposed in this chapter is the creation of a section relating to fees. Section 1310.10, subsection 2 of the North Dakota Century Code provides the commissioner may establish by rule a requirement providing for the payment of fees to apply for or renew licenses through the nationwide mortgage licensing system. As provided in the proposed rule, an applicant would be subject to a $25 fee for investigating the application and a $50 licensing fee. Additionally, the section provides for a $50 renewal fee. And finally, the section provides for a fee of up to $50 for a delinquent renewal and a $25 fee for processing a change of employment. The foregoing fees would be submitted through the nationwide mortgage licensing system. Unless there are any questions, Mr. Chairman, I'll...
Questions from the committee? Mr. Hendrick, I'm wondering if on page 34, item 5 there that you were talking about, in fact, the individual you mentioned raised the concern was in this very room yesterday and today testifying on legislation on these kinds of issues. What are you trying to accomplish with the regulation of collection firms in this area? I assume it's something along the lines of making idle threats or threats that go beyond the scope of what they're permitted to do by law.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, occasionally we will get a complaint about a collection agency that is telling the consumer that the sheriff is on the way to their house to arrest them, that type of thing.
Sure.
So
It never happens, of course.
Yeah.
It's just to intimidate the consumer. And so if we get that complaint, we can actually take action against them.
And how would you act? What are your prerogatives there?
We have the ability to remove employees, assess civil money penalties. So depending on the volume of complaints, we could probably remove that person.
Okay. And, you know, I'm just wondering, the concern that was expressed, you took the words or imply out after represent. So it originally read represent or imply that nonpayment of any debt will result in the arrest or imprisonment of any person, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering, unless it's lawful and they're legally entitled to bring such action, they intend to do so and so on. I'm wondering if by removing or imply, you're left with represent that nonpayment of any debt will result. That's a pretty affirmative kind of statement. And I'm wondering how that changes the intent here. I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, if you're telling somebody that, it seems to me that with this language they could imply or they could, you know, make statements that are general, that are vague or general, but mm-hmm. still give this impression, and they'd be off the hook. I'm just wondering, there's another way to do that. I'm just wondering if in the word will, on the line below that, I mean, if you say could result or, you know, will or could result or something like that, because, you know, if they are saying, if you're saying that you're only prohibiting them from specifically saying that if they don't do X, Y will happen, that's a very definitive statement. But if you're trying to prohibit them from implying that or from saying, and I understand the concern that was expressed that imply is vague, but maybe it's clearer if you were to say that if you don't pay your bill, we could take you to court. They can say that, I think, with the language you have here. What they can't say is that we will take you to court if it's something that they wouldn't be able to do. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. I'm just, you know, and I know that, and you may not know, and we've got a couple new members on the committee today because of retirements and elections and things, mm-hmm. and it's a good opportunity maybe to explain the prerogative of the committee is, you know, we can void rules if they don't meet certain statutory standards. One of those is keeping with legislative intent, and there are others. We can also agree with an agency of government to amend a rule that, you know, we feel, and this might be an example. I'm not saying we should do that. I'm just saying this would be an example where if you say, yeah, it's a good idea, let's fix that. It doesn't change the, you know, the major focus of what you're trying to do, and it's something that this committee would have the prerogative with in agreement with you to do. So just a little sidebar explanation there. Do you have any thoughts on that, or do you think the language is fine the way it is? I was just curious.
Mr. Chairman, if memory serves me, I'm trying to find the comment letter, but I believe the language mirrors language in the Fair Debt Collection Practices okay. Act.
If that's the case, it's probably best left alone, because that's federal law, so. Okay, good.
If I might, Mr. Chairman.
Did you say the original language or this language?
The or this language.
So does the Federal Debt Collection Act law have the or imply phrase in or not?
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall. It might. Okay. It very likely does.
Okay.
And so we modified it because we felt the implication was harder to prove as opposed to the outright statement that, you know, we're going to arrest you and throw you in jail and then they don't ever.
If they don't seem willing to, if they say we might, they're okay. Now.
True.
You know, so that's
well, Mr. Chairman, I would say that if they might, they would have to take that action. It has to be something that's available to them, and then they actually intend to take that action, and they do.
And, you know, and the word intend is another wiggle word. I mean, if they say, well, the day we said it, we intended to, but we changed our minds, so we aren't going to. I don't want to dwell on that, but I just, you know, I think you are changing a little bit of what your intent was there. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question here on page 52 of this book that we have, dealing with the fees. And generally, when the legislature legislature passes something that talks about fees, they name the fees. Evidently, they just said, we give you the authority to charge fees, and you can set them, and that's what you did here? Is that how this works?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is the language that's in the statute. It is, of the statutes that we have the authority to enforce, that's the only one that gives the commissioner the power to set the fees. The rest of them are in statute, but this one was included in statute.
Just a little.
See, no further questions, thank you. Thank you for your testimony, we appreciate it. Let's see, our next item, we're a little bit ahead of schedule, but our next item is the State Electrical Board. No, I'm sorry, it is the State Electrical Board. Our council tells us that they're not here and they're not going to be here. Apparently, they have something going on and they've notified council that they won't be here. Our rules say if they don't show up, that we automatically carry them over. However, we do have authority over them at this meeting, so if you really don't like them not being here, we could actually void the rules with that. But we ran into a bit of a quandary with this before because the question was, if somebody doesn't bother to show up, what do we do? We can still act on the rules, but we don't have them here to ask questions of and so on. So we did adopt a standard that says that, in law, that says that if they don't show up, they're automatically carried over to the next meeting unless we do something different with the rules. So if I don't hear a motion from the committee, that will be the action. We'll just carry
it. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thorson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. What happens if they don't show up again? Is it continued carry over and over and over?
I'll ask the council to answer that.
Should have looked at that. I believe if nobody shows up the second time, that those rules are
voided.
Gone. And we have to go back to square one.
Okay, I think that's correct.
If you have any clarification on that, for certain, I'd like to see, but I think that it's important to note that
yes.
Someone could just theoretically not show up and the rules would be there.
And that's what we were trying to prevent. And so that's why we put this into the statute.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure our council will check on that before we're finished here and respond. All right, so that item, our next item is actually scheduled for 2:55, but that is a presentation by the Industrial Commission. I don't know if they're in the room. It looks like they are. So we're ahead of schedule. Glad you're here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Administrative Rules Committee members. My name is Bruce Hicks. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oil and Gas Division. And I'm here to kind of give you an outline of what we're doing with the rulemaking on carbon dioxide sequestration. To understand really why we're here today, I think I need to give you a little bit of history on our rulemaking. In July of 2009, we passed some statutes along with your help on carbon dioxide storage, and they became effective at that time. The following April, we promulgated rules for geologic storage carbon dioxide. The following December of that same year, the EPA actually passed their rules and they became effective on the sequestration wells, and they required states to either go through their program and get primacy, or they would take over the program themselves for all the states. Well, the time has since passed, and effective now, EPA actually has jurisdiction over sequestration in all the states. We are going through the primacy portion ourselves. Some of the states have opted to actually take notice of the EPA rules and adopt them verbatim. We didn't think that was wise, and now we're going through the rulemaking to actually change ours to show that we have the same or higher stringency than they do. Going through that process was kind of interesting because the EPA actually didn't know their rules very well, and Kevin Connors, who will be going over our rules, actually knew the rules better than they did, and there were several of them that they tried to implement through our rules that we talked them out of. So
According to the Administrative Practices Act, we cannot adopt federal rules if they're irrelevant, and I was very happy to see that he had pushed that hard through that. So with that, I'll introduce Kevin Connors, and he'll go through it. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. As Mr. Hicks mentioned, I've become quite familiar with not only, of course, the rule that I've written, but the federal rule that I was using to meet the stringency of. And I've provided the committee with my testimony, and I was just going to kind of go through that and summarize that, and I welcome any questions along the way. So currently, EPA is the acting authority over North Dakota for when they created their federal regulations, they created a new class of injection wells under the Underground Injection Control Program. And that new class is Class 6 injection wells. And it's under Section 1422 of the Safe Drinking Water Act. So that essentially means that a state needs to apply for primacy enforcement authority. In order to obtain that primacy enforcement authority, they must show that their rules are at least as stringent as the federal rule. And so as Bruce alluded to, that's the work I've done. And part of that stringency demonstration with EPA, the process is we work through a crosswalk, and I'll just kind of show you this is the crosswalk, the first crosswalk. This has to do with the Class 6 rule. This crosswalk is 150 pages complete. It is a line-by-line, word-by-word, show your rule is as stringent as the federal rule. This is a very rigorous process, and it has taken quite some time and some effort to get to this point. And so when we did get to the point where, as you see in my testimony, number three there, our procedure for adopting these rules, we got to March of last year, and at that point, I had this crosswalk narrowed down to three issues. And in total, just for you some reference, there's 465 issues that I had worked out. And so I got down to three issues, and so we decided to move forward and start adopting this rule. We've made some ground. At that point, we did receive approval from the Industrial Commission to move forward and adopt the rule on March 19th. And as we began the process and filed our rules with Legislative Council, shortly after that, EPA came to me, and there was an issue where there was some additional requirements that had not been addressed in the crosswalk that I showed you. And so they provided me with another crosswalk to work through. And that added, at that point I was down to three issues, that added 346 additional issues to work with. So that substantially delayed the adoption of the rule process, and it kind of put a wrench in our adopting of the rule. And at that point we, just to kind of back up, there's a North Dakota comebackside work group that I worked with in developing these regulations. And that work group's made up of the Attorney General's Office, the Department of Health, of course the Oil and Gas Division, the North Dakota Petroleum Council, the Lignite Energy Council, the Energy and Environmental Research Center up in Grand Forks, and some additional individuals. So we worked extensively developing these regulations. At that point, the North Dakota CO2 work group requested an extended comment period of 45 days so we could kind of step back and look at some of these federal regulations that had just been kind of handed to me. At that point, we decided it was best to re-advertise, rehear the case, and have another comment period. So we went through a 45-day comment period. At that time, there was no comments received. Then we decided, that was June of last year, we went for the Industrial Commission, kind of gave them an update on where we were at and what had happened. And we worked through this second crosswalk, and I got through all 346 new issues with EPA. And last September, I actually got what we were working towards the entire time with EPA is a pre-approval of the regulations. So I have met the stringency of the federal required regulations. Our rule is at least as stringent as the federal rule. And that's when we decided it was time to move forward and start the adoption process essentially a second time. And we did re-advertise and rehear the case, and we had a second comment period, which was 10 days long. And that time we received an oral comment, which she also provided in written form, where there essentially was
the North Dakota CO2 work group testified in support of the rule, and they were the group that I've been working with all along. There's only one other comment that came in from a company of Willow Grove, and they submitted a comment. There was two errors in the rule where the cross references were essentially referencing the wrong section, and so I corrected those through comment. And those were the only comments received, and there was no comment in opposition to the rule. You know, the whole purpose of adopting these rules is to obtain primacy from EPA, so we have jurisdiction over these injection wells in North Dakota. Certainly right now we have a current rule on place that Mr. Hicks alluded to in the state of North Dakota, and then there's the federal rule that's in place. And in my mind, that's creating this dual regulation right now where it's a very unfriendly environment for any industry to come in with a project, because they would essentially have to get a permit from EPA and a permit from us. And so the objective here is to obtain primacy and combine those and get away from this dual regulation that we're currently in. And so I try to do my best to explain it to you, and I welcome any questions you may have. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Carr? Seeing none, I guess you've been very thorough. And by the way, we appreciate, I guess my question is, how difficult is it? I mean, I really personally appreciate, as a legislator and as a citizen, the work that you all do to try to make sure that this regulatory process stays within North Dakota and that we are not regulated by the bureaucrats from Washington, D.C. I don't use the term bureaucrat in a pejorative way, but simply because I think North Dakotans know better how to regulate things that go on within our borders. So I do appreciate all your efforts, and I think many of us feel that way, and just want to make sure you know that. How difficult is it to stay ahead of this with the EPA? I mean, you talked about this provision that we have that we can ignore rules if they're not applicable. Mm-hmm. I remember years ago we used to have the feds telling us we needed rules on how to fertilize pineapple crops, you know, things like that. And we said, guess what? We don't grow pineapples in North Dakota. We're not going to clutter our code with that stuff. And I'm glad we took that stand. How are you able to apply that? Maybe you can give us some examples and tell us how difficult it is really to convince them that we have it together and we can do our thing here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, honestly, my approach to the situation that others are directly explaining there was to learn the federal rule. And I sat down and I took the time and I read the CFR. And the CFR is, especially for the UIC program, it is not clear. It's confusing. But if you read it, that's essentially what you need to do. And so I had a leg up, in my mind, I had a leg up on EPA because I read their regulations. And honestly, we had some conference calls and meetings with EPA where I had to say, no, your regulation says this. And this provision is for EPA-administered programs only. And those are some of the regulations that they had in their crosswalk that they were trying to get us to adopt or show that we were as stringent as. And it clearly states that they're for EPA-administered programs, because EPA does have jurisdiction over different states and different parts of the UIC program. So, you know, that was very clear to me, and that was my approach was, I saw kind of a, I don't want to say a weakness, but it was essentially where I could just essentially learn their rule better than them. And
right. Well, congratulations on beating them at their own game, and it would have been fun to have been a fly on the wall. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Thank you, Commander. Appreciate it.
Next on our agenda is actually a 310 item, but I see the Board of Pharmacy folks are here. If you're ready to proceed, please do so.
Of the Minister of Rules Committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss the following rule change with you. For the record, my name is Mark Hardy, Assistant Executive Director of the North Dakota Board of Pharmacy. This may be a little bit of a duplication for those that are in the Senate Judiciary Committee today, as we'll be talking a little about synthetic drugs again, and the talk on how the Board of Pharmacy adopted the emergency rule regarding the synthetic drugs. Just different items are enumerated on my testimony, and I won't go through all of them. Just the important ones, I guess. So if you have any questions, feel free to stop me and ask me any questions. As you remember, in February 2010, the Board of Pharmacy adopted emergency rules on specific spice cannabinoids. During the 2011 legislative session, that language was codified. The Board of Pharmacy began receiving reports of additional spice cannabinoids and bath salts that were uniquely identified outside of the list of substances that were previously scheduled. The Board worked with the Attorney General's office to begin drafting legislation to be introduced during the current legislative session. Based on the increasing sale of these illicit substances and a suggestion from Chairman Koppelman during the interim meeting, it was determined that we could not delay in taking action, and an emergency rule by the Board of Pharmacy was necessary to help protect the public from the sale and movement of these dangerous spice cannabinoids and bath salts. Attorney General Stengel attended the November 21st board meeting to formally request the board's assistance in moving forward in adopting an emergency rule. The Board of Pharmacy is very supportive of this action and expressed the desire to take the steps necessary to protect the public's safety. Our office worked with the Attorney General staff member Edward Erickson to outline the specific steps necessary with an abundance of caution to safeguard the process and follow the statutory changes that were updated on the adoption of the emergency rules during the last legislative session. We specifically looked at the court cases of State versus Nickel and State versus Gibson to ensure issues that were identified in those court cases were addressed within our process of adopting these emergency rules. And I don't know if you remember some of the media reports regarding those two specific cases regarding them looking at the Board of Pharmacy's adoption of emergency rules and finding flaws that caused the cases to be thrown out. The Board held a special meeting on November 30, 2012, in which we heard from Attorney General Stengel, Shar Schweitzer, a forensic scientist with the North Dakota Crime Lab, members of the public who have been affected by these substances, and emergency room practitioners who have seen and treated individuals that have ingested these illicit substances. All supported the scheduling of these as quickly as possible. We had no comments that actually opposed the actions of the rule, except for a couple of threats. The Board of Pharmacy adopted the emergency rule on that date. The Board of Pharmacy addressed the immediate peril to the health, safety, and welfare of North Dakota citizens in the adoption of these rules. The necessary consultation and factors and findings of the Century Code 1903 were also addressed and are included in my testimony. And the emergency rules, along with a letter from the governor, were submitted to the Legislative Council that afternoon for publishing on their website. The board then took steps to ensure the public was informed of the adoption of these emergency rules by issuing a newspaper notice along with publication of both the Board of Pharmacy's website and the Attorney General's site as well. The board held a public hearing on emergency rules on January 9th in Fargo, at which time no members of the public appeared to comment and no comments were received during the open comment period. The approximate cost of the rule hearing was considerably more than average, since, as I mentioned, in the abundance of caution, we provided extra notice to the public to avoid any challenges to the rulemaking process, and that cost totaled $10,536. A regulatory analysis was prepared and a copy is enclosed in the testimony. And there's always some questions about how much lost sales could occur when people may no longer sell these products. However, it is not in the public interest to foster upon them drugs which may be harmful either intentionally or unknowingly. An economic impact statement and a regulatory analysis are also included in my testimony. And lastly, these rules were adopted as an emergency interim rule, as I mentioned earlier, under North Dakota Century Code 2832.03, pursuant to authority granted by you, the legislature.
A copy of the governor's letter is enclosed, and we have discussed the issues which caused the Board of Pharmacy to take action rather than waiting for the legislative session. It is important to note that House Bill 1070, which has passed both the House and the Senate, and once it is signed by the governor, will codify this language in this rule. The protection of the public health is the main purpose of the Board of Pharmacy, and this rulemaking authority under the Controlled Substance Act has served to provide this ability while we wait for you, the legislative session, to move these substances from rule to the statute, if you concur. And I appreciate your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you would have.
Questions for Mr. Hardy? I'm sorry, Senator Heckman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hardy, knowing what you do about the new substances that are out there, are you sure that you're covered enough with these so that as soon as you get these covered, a new one doesn't pop up someplace? Is there a general statement in here that covers that, or will there be?
Yeah, Chairman Koppelman and Senator Heckman, I think that's specifically what the Senate Judiciary Committee heard today about House Bill 1133. I believe that's the number, and that specifically talks about analogs of these substances and future creations of them. So what we did within the rule is we tried to be as inclusive as possible within the specific classes that the crime lab has tested for that we know of, including any isomers of the core chemical structure that could be created. Okay, and then we also took the approach to list every substance that the crime lab has positively identified under the specific section in which it would fall. So we felt the legislation is as inclusive as we know about at this time. There certainly is the possibility that you know, future chemical changes could be made or new substances could be created, but we hope that House Bill 1133 will address those kind of those substances in the future.
Senator Hogue, would you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and for the benefit of Senator Heckman, the Attorney General did testify this morning on that very problem that you identified. He said that there were, since passage of these rules, there were an additional six different substances that the crime lab has found that is to exist on the market. So he's actually asked us to amend that bill again, to add more to the statutory list. But yeah, there is we have another bill coming that came from the House that covers the analogs that are substantially similar to any that we specifically identify, so.
And that's all good information, and hopefully by putting some generic language in, the analogs, I don't know if we can say, or substantially similar to, but that's been the problem historically is that, for those of you that may not have followed this issue, that as these substances, these chemical substances that are sold as bath salts and other products, which are really very dangerous drugs that we oftentimes don't know what they are, and they're killing people. I mean, people are literally dying as a result of ingesting these. And we created these folks that come up with the chemical formula and say, we're going to ban this, and then they just tweak the chemical formula a little bit, and all of a sudden it's legal again. So we are trying to stay ahead of that. And I appreciate, Mr. Hardy, you commenting on my suggestion, because the history of this, if those of you who are either new to the committee or maybe haven't followed this completely, a few years ago, the Board of Pharmacy, Mr. Anderson, Senator Anderson now, created an emergency rule to try to get ahead of this problem when it first started rearing its ugly head. And the court case that Mr. Hardy referred to was one where a judge, a relatively new judge, who frankly I don't think maybe understood the administrative rule process very well, basically threw out the emergency rule, and the reason he gave for doing so was that proper notice wasn't given. And the notice, you know, it's supposed to be to affected parties, and I guess if you're buying bath salts, an affected party can be virtually anybody in North Dakota, and obviously you can't notify the whole state that a rule is being made. So the next legislative session, which I believe was the one 2 years ago, we actually adopted a statute to tighten that up and make the notice requirement not so onerous, so that hopefully this wouldn't happen again. And I appreciate, Mr. Hardy, you saying that you also took care in promulgating this rule, that you did the same, and hopefully that won't happen again. But as the Attorney General testified before this committee last summer, that this legislation we're now seeing was on its way, we asked, shouldn't you maybe do an emergency rule also to ensure that we get a handle on it earlier if we could. And the Board of Pharmacy followed through on that. I think they had a little bit of cold feet because of their prior experience, but I think we fixed it with that law change. And so I commend you for doing what you did. But let me ask you a housekeeping question. Since, as you pointed out, these rules are now going to be mirrored in law, I don't think it's wise for us to do anything with them today, but I'm wondering if it would be wise for us to hold them over until our next meeting, because if the statute encompasses everything you're trying to do here in rule, would you want to get rid of the rules then just as a housekeeping thing at our next meeting, perhaps, or at least look at that option?
Chairman Koppelman, I think we maybe want to consult the Attorney General on that, because there may be cases that they're prosecuting based off the rule. So I don't know if it would be
wise. Okay.
Yeah, it would be a good idea.
But you can always come back in your next rulemaking and delete the old rule.
That's,
but I just, it's more costly and take more time consuming to do that.
Chairman Koppelman, I think that's, and the other intention that we need to move on these is within the 180 days.
Right.
And that's why we had to get in within this meeting. We couldn't wait for the next one. So.
Understand.
Yeah.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, as new ones are added to the list, we wouldn't take these out, would we? We'd just add to them?
Chairman Koppelman and Representative Munson, once they're codified within the law, then we could eliminate the specific chemicals within the rule. As we're adding substances, we could certainly go through another emergency rulemaking process to add more substances if we need to in the interim. That would be my thing.
Continue.
Spice cannabinoid, or cannabinol,
it's not industrial.
Where actually do they find those?
Chairman Koppelman and Representative Munson, they're actually synthetically created. They're a marijuana, THC, or a derivative of that, but they're not available for a plant. You know, they're not derived from a plant like marijuana is, or THC is the active ingredient of marijuana. These are synthesized within by a chemist within processes, chemical processes to ensure that they're even more potent than THC, but even have more effect, hallucinogenic effect than what the plant-derived marijuanas are.
So spice, the term spice, does that mean it's aromatic? Does that mean that, you just said it has nothing to do with the plant, so mm-hmm. It's not like something you're going to grow and extract it from?
Yep. And Chairman Koppelman and Representative Munson, it's just the term they refer to it as. I'm not exactly sure why they call it spice. They often refer them as synthetic cannabinoids. Might be just another word for that as well. So,
in addition to bath salts, these are often marketed as incense too, aren't they?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Representative Munson's worried about his industrial hemp crop, but that's a... Any further questions for Mr. Hardy? Seeing none, thank you.
Yeah, and just a shout out to John. We appreciate his work with it too. It's always a pretty daunting deal when we get the Legislative Council to put together. So,
that was a stellar job. Thank you.
Unbelievable.
Council, did you learn any answers to questions yet about the second?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
Found out I was only half right.
Okay.
Should have known. As always, there are options.
All right.
With regard to the question on if nobody shows up at the first meeting, it's carried over. What if nobody shows up at the subsequent meeting? Held over for consideration. Rules are not considered initially considered by the committee under this section until a representative of the agency appears before the committee. If no representative appears before the Administrative Rules Committee meeting to which the rules are held over for consideration, the rules are void if the rules were adopted as emergency rules. And for rules not adopted as emergency rules, then the options come into play. The Administrative Rules Committee can void the rules, allow the rules to become effective, even though nobody showed up. I can't even imagine that happening. But it's an option.
We would never do that, would we?
Or hold them over again for yet another meeting. So I guess when the committee decided how to deal with this, didn't really want to close off any options because that's never happened before and there might be circumstances where you don't want to be foreclosed from cutting a break for somebody or saying, now that's it.
And we didn't want automatic adoption, but also years ago, the rules were in effect before we considered them. So the point you make about them not being considered until their first appearance is important because they're not in effect until they show up and talk to us and we allow them to take effect. So that's important for the agencies as well. If they want the rules to be effective, they better be here. All right. Thank you, Council, for that update. 325 item, we're a little bit ahead of schedule, is the Board of Podiatric Medicine. Are they here yet? Yes. Please come forward. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chairman Koppelman and members of the Administrative Rules Committee, my name is Jill.
Excuse me, would you pull the mic towards you a little down a little bit so you, there we go. I'm going to hear you better. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Jody Wiedmeyer, and I am the Executive Secretary for the North Dakota Board of Podiatric Medicine. By statute, the board is responsible for regulating the practice of podiatry in North Dakota. On behalf of the board, which is composed of 4 podiatrists, 1 medical doctor, and 1 public member from throughout the state, I'm here to speak in support of the administrative rules amendments submitted and set forth in pages 149 through 148 of your materials. The North Dakota Board of Podiatric Medicine has submitted amendments to 8 different sections in Title 63 of the North Dakota Administrative Code. The rules amended are not related to any federal statute or regulation. No regulatory analysis was required or issued. No regulatory analysis or economic statement of impact on small entities was required or issued. These rules have no fiscal effect on state revenues for expenditures. No fiscal note was issued, and no constitutional takings assessment was required or prepared, and these rules were not adopted as emergency rules. The process to amend the rules began in January of 2011. The board at its meetings in January and May reviewed the North Dakota Administrative Code as it related to the practice of podiatry in the state and determined that certain updating of the rules was necessary. The board instructed me to work with the board's attorney to draft proposed amendments based upon the specific sections discussed at the meetings. The board was presented with the draft amendments and moved to proceed with the administrative rules amendments process at its May 12th, 2012 meeting. A notice of intent to amend administrative rules and a copy of the proposed rules were provided to the North Dakota Legislative Council on September 10th. An abbreviated notice of intent to amend administrative rules was published in all official county newspapers. This was facilitated through the North Dakota Newspaper Association. All notices were published on or before September 26th, and a public hearing was held on October 23rd. I presided over the hearing and no one appeared. A public comment period was held open through November 5th of 2012. No written or oral comment, concern, complaint, or objection was received by the board. On November 19th, the proposed rules and supporting documentation were submitted to Attorney General Wayne Stengem for a legal opinion. The Attorney General's opinion was received by the board on January 17th, 2013. The opinion approved the proposed rules for legality on the condition that the word confidential be removed from section 6304.01.02, subsection 1B. This information was presented to the board on January 25th, 2013, and the proposed rules, as revised, were adopted by the board and submitted to the Legislative Council for publication. The approximate cost associated with the adoption of these rules was $3,100. This included the publication cost of $1,687.10 and the legal fees from the North Dakota Attorney General's office and the board's attorney. The first section amended is section 6301.0101 on page 151 of your materials. This amendment did result from a statutory change. However, this was not from the most recent legislative assembly. In reviewing the administrative code, it was discovered that the number and type of board members had been changed by statute at some point previously, but the administrative code had not been amended to reflect this change. This amendment corrects that oversight. Section 6301.0301 on page 152 simply updates the board contact information. Section 6302.0101 on page 153 relates to the application requirements for licensure. This rule now also requires the board to perform individual state background checks on all applicants. The board believes that such a requirement is necessary before the issuance of a license to practice podiatry in the state. Section 6302.0402 on page 154 provides for the issuance of a temporary permit for a podiatrist that is completing a clinical residency program. Currently, there is no residency program in the state of North Dakota for podiatrists. However, one is in the planning stages. Such a program would be beneficial to the state, and the board was implored to allow the temporary permit certificate to be renewed annually in order to give the podiatric resident the time needed to complete the program. Section 6302.0801 on page 155 relates to the various fees payable to the board. The application fee, temporary license fee, and relicensure fee were increased from $150 to $300. The fees in this section are the board's only source of revenue and need to provide for all of the board's operating costs. This section has not been adjusted since 1996. The recent reorganization and centralization of the board's office, the increase in operating expenses over the years, and the increased costs associated with the new requirement of background checks for all applicants make these increases necessary. Section 6303.0201 on page 156 relates to the podiatrist's continuing medical education requirements. The board adopted a policy allowing podiatrists to complete 60 credit hours of CME in the immediate 3-year period prior to renewal, instead of requiring the 20 credit hours of CME for each yearly renewal period. The board amended this section to provide for a little more flexibility for the podiatrist while continuing to require basically the same amount of CME for the renewal. Section 6303.0204 on page 156 removes the limitation of 8 hours of CME credit for self-study. As technology changes and online courses become a well-established avenue for CME, the board felt the 8-hour maximum was unnecessary. Even with the limitation removed, the board still maintains the authority to approve all CME credits. Lastly, section 6304.0102 on page 157 relates to the board's duty to investigate and prosecute complaints. Based upon recommendations from its attorney, the board determined that its policies and procedures in relation to the investigation of complaints needed to be clearly set forth. These rules now require that the podiatrist who is the subject of the complaint receive a copy of the complaint and be allowed an opportunity to respond, and that the board must make specific findings after the investigation has been completed. If further formal action is warranted, the podiatrist must be served a copy of the formal complaint with the charges specifically set forth. Or if the board determines no further action is warranted against the podiatrist, the complainant and the podiatrist must be provided written notice of the dismissal. The board and its attorney determined that these changes would better serve the board, the licensees, and the public. Thank you. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 155, dealing with your fees.
Yes.
The legislature set these fees, or did the board set these fees?
There are limitations in the statute that the board must be under. For instance, the renewal fee is limited at $500. So these fees are set by the board within the statute's limitations.
Might continue.
Continue.
When did the legislature make the law change Because it seems to me like it was a lot of years ago since we've let or had anything to dealing with fees for the podiatrists.
Right. The podiatrists haven't, I believe, changed their fees in quite some time, except for there was a period where they increased their renewal for a time period to repay a loan, I believe, and then they reduced the fee back to the $500. I do not believe that the other fees have been adjusted.
Was there a, wasn't there an issue with, I don't remember the incident, it doesn't matter, but something that was costly, a legal issue or something that...
Yes, the board had prosecuted a complaint against a podiatrist that had, I think, went all the way up to the Supreme Court and cost the board quite a bit of fees, legal fees and things.
So that was a, that interim or intermittent increase in fees, and then they came down, it looks like now you're bumping them up pretty significantly.
The renewal fee for the podiatrists that are currently practicing remained the same. The only fees that were changing would be the application fee and the, it's the application fee and the relicensure fee, which typical to the, and the temporary license fee. And the temporary license fee is going up because we are finding that it's costing us more to process the applications and to issue the temporary licenses, and so then that's part of the reason that those fees specifically are going up.
Is a temporary license the same as a temporary permit, or is that...
No. The temporary permit relates specifically to residents. And
okay.
The temporary license is simply a license that's issued once the application is approved by the president of the board, but the board doesn't meet to actually do the initial interview with the applicant, and so there is a time period there where they're able to practice. Because the board does only meet once a year, so it's kind of hard for somebody trying to come into the state to wait perhaps, 9, 10 months before they can actually start practicing.
And to that point, it appears, I'm looking at your rule here on page 154,
mm-hmm.
It appears that your old language had what resulted in a two-year maximum. It was a 12-month thing that could be renewed one time, and now it appears it's sort of open-ended or unlimited. Is the intent to allow people to hang out there forever in this residency?
No.
Neverland, or...?
It's eligible for renewal. Part of the reason we need to extend that is because typically it takes a podiatric resident now 3 years to complete. It may take them a little bit longer, but typically it makes 3 years. But they are only allowed to have the permit as long as they're participating in the residency program. So the board does have the option of not renewing that if it becomes problematic, if they're terminated from the residency program or simply drop out for medical reasons or just for...
But your intent or the result of your rule is that it will basically be up to the board, that there wouldn't be any hard and fast...
That would be correct, as long as they're involved in the residency program. The board wouldn't be able to extend the license past that.
Okay. Representative Bain.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess two questions. When you have the temporary license, does that automatically roll over into the permanent license, or do they have to pay another fee?
No, it does not automatically roll over. They do have to appear before the board, and the board has to move to grant them the license. And once they do that, they are required to pay a prorated fee for the remainder of the annual fee.
So they
for the remainder of the year.
So they don't have to pay a double fee then?
Correct.
And then one other question. On page 152, on the changing of the address, Ms. Chen, didn't we and some other, haven't we allowed them to not have to change their address and closure so they don't have to? I think we did that in some other council.
Well, Mr. Chen, Representative Bain, the address changes, that whole organizational rule thing is not considered substantive, so agencies can just send me notice and we make the change. But the board submitted that with the rules, so we
okay.
Can get them all
as long as they're doing it anyway. But yeah. Okay, good point. I do have another couple of questions, ma'am. Mm-hmm. The background checks, and you referred to that on page 153, I assume like many, many other boards and groups in North Dakota, you have, there's legislation that requires background checks now for applicants, or is that not true?
No, not for the podiatrists. We don't have anything in our statute that requires that, but the board did determine that they needed to do their share at trying to federate out any type of criminal issues that may be in an applicant's background.
The other entities that do that have asked for statutory authority to do it. Do you need that?
We looked into that. The ones that require the statutory authority are those that are doing the federal background checks through the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
The board researched that in talking to the Bureau of Criminal Investigation and other boards, and there's it became unfeasible for this board, basically for cost reasons.
Okay.
There's certain rules and regulations that need to be filed. Legislation needs to be submitted and,
right,
and granted. And then there's also certain record keeping requirements that the board is just not set up to do. So the best that the board can do at this point is to contact each state separately and require that. So it's a little more work on our end, and it's not quite as thorough, but it's what we can do.
So is it a desire to move to that? Do you see yourself requesting?
You know, I think that the board would like that. I don't know that it's feasible in the near future, but hopefully as things become more technological and record keeping is able to be kept in the manner that they need, then most definitely I think the board would like to see that.
And of course, in any kind of medical practice, you know, the concern is always protecting,
right,
people in North Dakota,
exactly,
and so on. So
exactly.
I know you share that concern, I'm sure. My last question is, you were talking in your original testimony, your original comments,
mm-hmm,
about the Attorney General's office requiring you to remove the word confidential somewhere. Where was that?
That was on the page 157, and it was under 6304.102, subsection 1B.
Okay.
The board had initially indicated that, I don't have the original, no, I don't have the original language. It wanted to indicate that the board may issue a confidential letter of concern. The Attorney General determined that we did not have statutory authority to a confidential letter of concern. And we, after discussing it with the attorney and visiting more with the Attorney General, we simply removed that phrase.
Okay.
So that we would be in compliance with the statute.
Well, I suspected, but I just wanted to.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry, Representative Franzbach, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jody, why the change in the number of board members from 5 to 6?
You know, that was before I came to the board, and we simply discovered it when I was comparing the statutes to the administrative code, and so I'm sorry, but I don't really know why or when that was changed. I apologize.
I don't know for sure either, but I wonder if that wasn't back when there were some issues with the particular...
You know, I don't know, and I guess I could only suspect that things were reviewed, and I don't know if the governor required, like, a public member was added.
Sounds like something that was probably legislated, but I'm wondering if it was in response to some issues that,
right, and
that were there before.
I do apologize, but I didn't do the research to,
okay,
determine that. We just figured we better get the administrative code and the statutes on the same page.
Exactly.
So I apologize
all
for
right,
not having the answer to your question.
All right. Well, seeing no further questions, thank you very
thank
much
you.
For your testimony. All right, members of the committee, we are considerably ahead of schedule now, which is good. Next item up is the Education Standards and Practices Board. And I don't think they're here yet, so they're only 5 minutes away. So we will stand at ease for 5 minutes as we wait for them.
All the meetings on the creation of this committee and this room, and all the meetings on tweaking this committee,
mm-hmm,
and I must say that the final result works pretty well. The fact that there is the 4 times a year, it is known what's coming up, and I hear that from people we work with, and I just thought I'd share it. It wasn't written here, but I think we got it right.
We really appreciate that. I want to thank you. We've been in these meetings together a lot, and
yes, we have.
The sausage tastes pretty good in here.
Well, it's better than previous recipes. Okay. The second thing that I want to point out that really is one of the questions is that I do not need to ask for an extension of the permission, the 9-month deadline on the rules that implement the statute for small wind farms, unless you don't approve these today, because they're in this packet. This is a packet that includes all of our siting rules and then a few other small rules. So, not the only one in the first question, the only one in this packet, and I'll just tell you generally, the packet includes three that were in one case relating to public utilities. One was how long parties have to respond to discovery requests, because under civil rules they have 30 days, and that's way too much time in a rate case if you're supposed to be done in 6 months, and we've shortened it to 10 days. There was no objection or comment to that. The next one is the adoption of the most current version of the Electrical Safety Code. Again, no real interest or comment on that. The third one is the repeal of the prohibition on master metering. And master metering is simply when you have an apartment building, we've explained it a little further on, and you kind of have one meter as opposed to individual meters. We had a prohibition on that from the days of the 70s energy crisis with exceptions. And we were seeing more requests for exception and less reason for the rule. And so it is repeal is proposed. And again, we had there was no controversy about that at the hearing. The final rule, the siting, one portion of the siting package deals with something from the 2011 session, and that is lowering the jurisdictional threshold for siting wind farms to 1/2 megawatt. Everything else went up to, or down, I can't even remember, it's moved around much, is at 50 megawatts. Wind farms are at 1/2, but these rules then implement a streamlined procedure for handling smaller wind farms. And that was the part that I was asking for extensions on last couple times I was here. Nothing in the packet is required by federal law, but of course the National Electrical Safety Code is a federal publication. It's not required that we adopt it, but it's only logical that we adopt it. The procedure is the same as you've heard 1,000 times. We do put these cases together to save money, and we did have all of these plus a reclamation rulemaking in the packet. So we had three cases in this packet, so we allocated 2/3 of the cost to these two cases, and the reclamation rules are not before you because they have to go to the federal government for approval first. It will be coming later. Page 4 talks about the comments and concerns. There was generally no concerns. There was a comment made by the Air Force for how we worded, I'm trying to find it quickly here. Kevin, I'm on page 5. Kevin Nelson submitted a couple of emails suggesting that we word the setback from whatever wording we had to nuclear missile launch facility, or from nuclear missile launch facility to intercontinental ballistic missile ICBM launch or launch control facility. We have had more interest in our siting cases from the Air Force because of the sites that are sometimes potentially impacted or in the vicinity of pipelines or wind farms. So we simply took their language and put it in the rule and made that change. And I really, when we get to the regulatory analysis and takings and small entity type assessments, the testimony does discuss it. Pretty much there was no impact in any of those areas. There is a little bit of a discussion on page 7 about how the National Electrical Safety Code might impact entities, but not sufficiently to cause any change in the rule, and also it would be impractical to have less stringent standards than the National Electrical Safety Code, even if there was an impact, because you want the safety requirements to be consistent across the board. If you have specific questions on those, one of our engineers is with me today, and he's the one that produces this information for me when I have to put a rules package together, so he can address that a little further. He also is the same engineer that handles all the wind siting cases, and so if you have specific questions about that, I'm gonna suggest that we bring him up to the podium. A couple of things in siting, there were some other general changes that we made. I don't think any were controversial, but I should bring them to your attention. We used to have a packet on our website. Well, before the days of website, we handed it out. It's the same packet from the 70s when the law was written, and it was called guidelines. And we would always say, you know, one of these days we're going to get those in the rules. Well, this was the time to no longer have guidelines. If you're going to make a company do something, you're supposed to do it by rule. And so we updated them because they were out of date to some extent, but we also incorporated what was valuable into the rule. So there are no more guidelines, there are simply rules for how to file a siting application. We also updated service so that we could serve many entities by electronic mail. You know that we need to serve local officials. If you're going to site a wind farm in a county, you have to serve the county officials, and you have to serve legislators from that area, and you have to serve legislators, of course, if you have a new proposed rule. And we had updated these notices also to people like the Air Force or to Federal Fish and Wildlife, something, to be able to do that by email. We would continue to serve jurisdictional documents to get jurisdiction over an intervener or an applicant or something by mail, but we did change the rules to make these other notices able to go out by email. And then one last thing that I would like to bring to your attention is at the very end on page 9. When I previously appeared, there were some questions about decommissioning wind farms and about bonding rules. And I have attached at the very back of the packet the decommissioning rules. And there is a rule in there, 6909-0908, and this has been adopted since 08, that does allow the commission to require a bond. And I didn't remember that. I remembered a lot of discussion and a lot of tweaking during the creation of those rules, but I never remembered to tell you at the last meeting that we had the rule. I just didn't remember it, but now you have your own, very own copy. And that's the end of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions or offer Jerry Lean to answer questions.
Questions from Ms. Jeff Kotsacko. I do have one on the when you talked about these that you've asked for extensions on and so on, and it's for small wind operations. Am I understanding that? How's that going
to
work?
Yes, and I'm going to try to flip to them so that I can. Actually, we do think that we have enough authority now to have a streamlined procedure, but. I gotta find what I'm talking about while I'm dabbing.
Sure.
Because we did one, the one at Devil's Lake at the college. Okay, so we think there's enough flexibility, but we and the companies were hoping that we could be more specific so everybody knew what to do. So I'm just gonna page through here and look for it.
Makes us feel better if you can't find what you're looking for.
Well, I don't remember exactly. I should have flagged it. Do you remember, Jerry, exactly where it is?
It,
there is a minimum you mentioned, certain...
A half megawatt.
Half a megawatt, so...
Jerry tells me everything's going to be at least that big.
So if someone just puts up a turbine for whatever reason, decides I want to create some of my own wind energy, or I want to create a little bit, sell a little bit back into the grid, if they can do that, is there a level under which you don't get involved? Is that what we're saying?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's that half megawatt, but I really don't know what type of turbine would be half megawatt. Jerry, do you want to come up and answer that, and I'll look for the rule?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You'll still have to answer it, and I'll still kind of refresh my recollection. Or you can...
Mr. Chairman, anything under a half megawatt would be probably something on a... From a practical aspect, something on somebody's farm, a little small machine that he's using just for his own use.
Okay.
If you're getting to a commercial grade or utility grade, right now, pretty much the 1.5 megawatts are about as small as you get.
Okay.
So that's what the half megawatt was meant to cover.
I was in Germany in November looking at their renewable energy changeover that they're doing, their conversion, which is kind of fascinating. And they're encouraging literally every individual household to do something. I mean, and some have solar and some have wind, and I mean, I don't know that we'll ever get to that, but it did occur. I mean, I don't know if you want to be in the business of regulating all of that. It sounds like something like that would be under that threshold.
Yeah, and this is just for the siting.
Yes, I understand. All right, thank you. Any further questions for the PSC? Seeing none, thank you. Counselor, yes.
Chief Counselor.
Solar City.
Mr. Chairman, on page 195, I just under number six, you're changing from Department of Labor to Labor Department, and we just passed that bill in the second chamber. It passed the House and the Senate. Now it's going to be the Department of Labor and Human Rights. So if you could make that change, so you don't have to come back another time just to correct that, I thought, as well.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think that we would certainly do that, but I also think legislative council can do that automatically, even if these take effect. Isn't that true, if the thing doesn't exist anymore?
It wakes them up to me. I don't sit reading it.
Right. And these rules will be effective sooner than, well, I don't know the bill, and I don't know if it has an emergency clause, but I'm expecting the rule to be effective sooner than the bill. And everybody we know is waiting for these rules to get effective because they want to know the new rules. So maybe we should have the automatic change, and I'll just send you a note to that effect when that bill's effective, if that would be okay.
That'll work.
I did, if possible, I did want to point out, it is on page 30 of the, not of your book necessarily, but of the rules that are attached to the order in my testimony. And it is a new... article, or chapter, excuse me, 6906 something, and it talks, this is for the small wind farm.
We don't know the number though, what, 6906?
Well, we don't have a number.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's after 6906-0902 is okay. Where we put it. I don't know if you have a number already, John, in there. It's actually going to be probably the end of the packet.
Right. Well, I think we do have it.
And?
Small wind.
Yep. 6906-10.
Okay. And you'll notice that it goes from a half megawatt to 20 megawatts.
Okay.
So if it's bigger than 20, it's under the standard procedure. But again, there's a lot of flexibility in the standard procedure.
Okay.
And it basically just says... They're exempt. I mean, there's not a lot of... We really wanted to be able to work it out whatever's best.
Okay.
And then we said, but you can't do this by daisy chaining together a bunch of little ones and
sure.
Get out of the statute. So that's really all it does.
All right, very good. Representative Francois, is your microphone on? Did you have a question?
Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. I just thought... All right. Thank you very much. Seeing no further questions. Next on the agenda is the North Dakota Board of Clinical Laboratory Practice.
Good
proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Copeland, members of the Committee.
Would you push your button there on the microphone for us?
Oh, I'm sorry. I put the light on. I thought it was on.
Yeah, it's confusing. Thank you.
I'll start over. Good afternoon, Chairman Copeland and members of the Administrative Rules Committee. My name is Bruce Pritchett, and I am an ex officio member of the North Dakota Board of Clinical Laboratory Practice. I'm testifying on behalf of the Board of Clinical Laboratory Practice today. And the pages I will be addressing in your manual will be 224 through 228. It's chapter 9602-1001, Exempt Tests and Methods. And I will just go down the guidelines that are provided one at a time. The rules did not result from statutory changes made by the Legislative Assembly. The rules are not related to any federal statute or regulation. The Board followed the rulemaking procedures established in the Legislative Council's Administrative Rules Drafting Manual. One public hearing was held on December 4th, 2012. Notice for the public hearing was posted in all North Dakota newspapers through the North Dakota Newspaper Association. No written or oral comments were received regarding these rules. The approximate cost of giving public notice and holding the hearing was $1,700. The Board accepts requests from the public, usually from clinical laboratories, for additional lab tests they wish to have added to the list of those tests that can be performed by a person without a clinical lab board license. Each year, by July 1st, requests are received and reviewed by a subcommittee of the Board. The subcommittee makes recommendations to the Board to either add the test to the list or to not add the test to the list. The Board considers the reasons and recommendations for all tests or test methods submitted. There is a set of criteria that must be met for the test method to be considered. And the reason for this is that technology improves, lab testing kits, methods, devices are manufactured with the same improvements as well. The improvements make the process simpler, more accurate, and more sensitive. And they make it more foolproof for conducting the testing. This creates a need for the Board to continually update the list of simple tests for the good of the public that are using them to test themselves. Periodically, the Board goes through the rulemaking process to add these simple tests on the list or to the list. On page 228, you will see the clinical lab test or methods under 96-02-1001. Under number 9, it's underlined that we're planning to add this year. There are a couple other changes as well you'll see underlined. Regulatory analysis was not required by the NDCC section 283208. A regulatory analysis or economic impact statement of impact on small entities was not required by the Century Code 283208.1. These rules do not have a fiscal effect on the state revenues and expenditures, including any effect on funds controlled by your agency or our agency. A constitutional takings assessment was not prepared as required, and the rules were not adopted as emergency rules under Section 283203. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? What does this rule really do in terms of what you've added?
What we've added is, under number 9, the words in at the beginning, what we were finding was the tests listed below A through D have been there for a number of years, but we were getting questions from the clinical laboratory saying, well, it doesn't make a difference whether the methodology uses antibodies or antigens to make the detection. And we decided that we really didn't care whether they used antibody detection or antigen detection. And I'm getting down in the weeds a little bit here, but so we changed the wording so it could be either. That affects all the tests under number 9. And then E and F were added this year. Hepatitis C virus. There are several kits. They're simple to use. Hepatitis C is becoming way too common, the public health units especially have asked us to add some option for those people that don't have a clinical lab or a license to actually run this test in the public health labs. So that's why we added that one. Respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, if you have any kids or grandkids, they've probably been treated for RSV before. Again, the test is very simple for detecting it, and it is an antibody or antigen test, and we felt would help the public a lot if the test could be done possibly by someone that doesn't have a clinical lab board license but is under supervision by that individual.
All right. I'm just curious about the wording of your rule. I'm looking at the statute that you cite here under your professional clinical laboratory personnel, 4348, but it says, an individual supervised by an individual licensed by the board performing the following Food and Drug Administration wave tests and using the following methods is exempt from the provisions of North Dakota Century Code Chapter 4348. Now, there's a section in that, there's a subsection in that section of code about exemptions. The provisions of this chapter do not apply to the following, and it lists physicians, nurses, and others, and so on. So that deals with people. I'm just trying to figure out, what caught my eye was I don't know how you exempt something that's in statute by rule. And that's what caught my eye, but I'm trying to figure out in a practical sense. I'm not saying you're doing something you're not authorized to do. The wording looks a little bit strange to me there.
We have in statute that if you're testing human body substances for diagnosis, prevention, treatment, that you need to have a clinical laboratory license to do that. We also recognize that there are a whole lot of laboratory tests that use human body substances that are so very simple that we cannot license everyone to do them. So the way we worked around that was to indicate that we have a list, and this is the list we're working on. We have a list of tests that are so simple that we don't really care who does them as long as they have some supervision by a person that is currently licensed by the Board of Clinical Laboratory Practice. They have to have them competency evaluated once a year, and then they can do any test on this list. So we are changing the list of tests. We're not really changing the requirements as to who can do them or who does the oversight, just the list of tests that are available to these people.
Do you know what specific, I mean, you just cited your chapter. Do you know what specific item in that chapter that you're talking about with regard to the exemptions and the limitations on the tests and so on?
43, what's that number?
4348 is the section.
Okay.
But is Mr. Anderson your, no. Erickson rather, your, no? I see you looking over there.
Are you talking about?
I'm looking at 4348, in the Century Code, which is your area of practice,
right.
Chapter dealing with clinical laboratory personnel and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I understand what you're saying. What's confusing me, anytime I see something that says, this is a rule and we're exempting what the code does, what the Century Code does, that sounds, I don't think that's what's happening here, but it sounds like an overreach because you can't throw law out the window with rule. So, but if there's something in the rule that says you have the authority to make a list or exempt things or whatever, I'm looking for that, and I think maybe it would be wise for you to cite that when you make these rules, that specific subsection, if you've got one. We don't need to dwell on this right now, but I just
do.
Something you might want to take a look at.
This is chapter 43.
Why don't you just look into that when you have some time, and I don't think it's substantive for this particular rule that you've made, but it might be something if you've got counsel or somebody that helps
sure.
you, or you can even check with our counsel as well about maybe how to make sure you're dotting that I and crossing that T correctly.
All right.
Thank you. See no further questions? Appreciate your
Thank
testimony.
You. Mm-hmm.
Next item on the agenda is, and you're still about exactly on time, a presentation by the Board of Integrative Healthcare. And I'm not, nobody's leaving. Oh, there we go. All right.
No, I think there's steps. There's steps.
She's got them crosswise for skin sex. Let me see. I think they're short.
Did you get three pages of them?
You got them?
Okay. All right. I guess we're okay.
Okay. Hello, everyone, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Link. I am a doctor of naturopathic medicine. I was appointed to represent naturopathic medicine within the North Dakota Board of Integrative Healthcare. I currently serve as the chairperson for the board. I'll start by addressing the requested questions. These are initial rules for the board. The board has been operating directly under the statutes in chapters 4357, 4358, and 4359. These rules are not mandated by federal law. We follow the rulemaking procedure outlined in Chapter 2832 of the Administrative Agencies Practice Act. There were no comments received during the rulemaking process. The cost of giving public notice was $1,687.10, paid to the North Dakota Newspaper Association on December 6, 2012. The board regulates two professions, naturopathic doctors and music therapists. The administrative rules outline the requirements for application of licensure, responsibilities of the regulatory board, and the responsibilities of the licensee to maintain a license in the state of North Dakota. Furthermore, the administrative rules explain the disciplinary actions to be taken against a licensee to protect the public against fraudulent or dangerous activity. A regulatory analysis is not required because these rules are expected to have less than a $500,000 economic impact, and an analysis was not requested from the board. The board is an occupational licensing board and is exempt from the requirement of an economic impact statement under North Dakota Century Code Section 2832-08 something 1.5, however you read that. These rules do have a fiscal effect on state revenues and expenditures. A copy of the fiscal note is included. It's the second document located after my testimony. So you should have got three. Yep, so most of you have it. Updates to the fiscal note include the pending licensure of two additional naturopathic doctors and two additional music therapists that just, their applications just came into the board this past quarter. The rules do not affect the use of real property, and the board did not prepare a takings assessment. And these are not emergency rules. They're brand new. So, thank you for your attention. I will answer any and all questions to the best of my ability.
Questions for Ms. Link. What is a naturopath or naturopathic doctor?
We basically are licensed as general family practitioners or family physicians in the state. We can diagnose, treat, and our founding paradigm is basically that the body has an ability to heal itself and that we can assist the body to do that. We take a holistic approach and look at diet, lifestyle, stress, physiologic and biochemical pathways within the body that may be genetically predisposing somebody to having celiac disease, for instance, and how do we treat from a non-pharmaceutical standpoint, but from a nutraceutical or supplementary standpoint through lifestyle modification, diet, kinds of different therapies.
Now, you said a family
family physician or a family...
Yeah, we're considered on the same level in the general family practice.
But you're not an MD.
Not an MD.
So you're not regulated by the...
No.
By the...
No, it's the Board of Medical Examiners, no. And nor the North Dakota Board of Osteopathy.
Okay.
So we are independent.
All right, and
they don't want us.
We got our own. I do vaguely remember the bill from last session. I was just looking at it quickly at the statute to... what you're setting forth here, it looks like, in addition to the organization of your board, is a whole list of unprofessional conduct regulations and sanctions and so on. Are you... Did you look somewhere for a model? Are there other states that are doing something similar? Other professions within our state? Or how did you...
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we actually borrowed language already written for boards that are already approved in this state. We looked at, pooled about 4 to 5 different boards, the Board of Medical Examiners, the North Dakota Chiropractic Board, the Board of Osteopathic Medicine, and I believe the North Dakota Pharmacy Board as well. And so if there was already a way of doing something, we basically borrowed that and we didn't reinvent anything, basically.
On the music therapy area, and it's kind of an odd mix to have you both in the same camp, I think, but... One of the concerns that was mentioned when the legislation came through is that, you know, there are people that are, music therapy is kind of a new, relatively new at least, field, and some people who have various qualifications and talents are practicing, if you want to use that term, or involved in music therapy, and there seems to be a kind of a moving target in terms of what constitutes a music therapist, how they're qualified, how they should be regulated. I think one of the things we want to avoid doing here is getting too stringent and fence building. And this, if I remember what we heard last session, most states, and this is kind of unusual, most states aren't doing this yet?
No, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, North Dakota is actually, was either the first or second state to license music therapists. It's brand new. We were in discussion with committee members in Nevada on how to proceed because they didn't want their bill to be so different and than our rules, I should say, not their bill. And so there was no framework really to build rules upon. And we talked a lot with their national association, and they have a few problems of weeding out previous different levels of education. And so that's what their national association is trying to do by the certification number, if you need them here, and approved schools. And UND is now an approved school, and they have a lot of graduates, and they would like to license those and regulate those graduates within this state. So it was difficult, I'd say.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Would you have any objection? Confession here, I have not had a chance to really read these the way I would like to, since they're all new rules. We're in the middle of a legislative session, so we don't have the kind of time we normally would to review something coming into one of these meetings. This is an unusual meeting of our committee. We meet quarterly, but it's usually during a time when the legislature is not in session. Do you have any urgent need for these rules to be effective today, or would you have any objection to the committee carrying them over for consideration until our next meeting, when we might have an opportunity? We can do it even over your objection, but I'm just asking, you know, I think one of the concerns that I would have, and I don't know, other members of the committee might share this, that being a new regulated and licensed profession in North Dakota, two new professions, you know, we want to help you do everything you're talking about, but by the same token, we want to make sure, particularly in an area that has been potentially practiced before but not licensed and regulated before, that we're not being exclusive, that we're not building fences, that we aren't precluding people from doing what they've done before or might want to come here and do. Would you have any objection if you kind of continue a conversation with us over the next few months, and we can
look at your rules and see if we might want to suggest some changes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, personally, I don't. They haven't stopped the board from doing what it's already been licensed by, I guess you'd say, statute to do.
Exactly.
So if it's, if it makes everybody more comfortable, that's fine. I was told that the Senator Porter was looking at adding another group to our board, and this board was designed to be a small professions group. I believe they are perfusionists, is what I was just told before the meeting. They're looking for a home. So that is one issue that we are facing, as we have been approached by other groups that would like to have a board to go to session, and
sure,
without rules, we don't feel like we have a framework. Because there is a large cost with every new group that wants to come, so we'd like to have them be prepared with their bill in hand, with an idea of how they would like to potentially fund administrative rules hearings and different items, so that we don't tax the board by having to come to administrative rules hearings every 2 years.
Sure.
So.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you. So no further questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Mr. Erickson.
For the record, I'm Edward Erickson with the Attorney General's Office. I'm General Counsel for the Board of Integrative Healthcare. I'm here not to offer testimony, but to answer any technical questions. I'd like to just first start off, Mr. Chairman, and point out specifically in relation to your question concerning music therapists. If you look at 112-03-01-02, you'll see that we have a route to licensure for people working with the Certification Board for Music Therapists, and also people working with the National Music Therapy Registry. Both of, is my understanding from discussions with the board in developing these rules, that these are the two umbrella organizations that existed. If we had been aware of a third one, they would probably be here. But we had, was it the people from the UND or NDSU program?
UND, and then the national, the first one was them.
And we also had the national groups participating in developing the rules.
Okay, very good. All right, seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Erickson, for your input. Appreciate it. All right, well, members of the committee, that brings us to the close of our scheduled hearings. We have Ms. Welk here. Have you had an opportunity to look at wording at all? And I think that Senator Andrus had one thought, but I know you've been back there looking and reading and writing feverishly, so.
Mr. Chairman, I hope I'm not so far into the forest that I can't see the trees, but this is what I've come up with. It should be what I'm thinking, minor changes. So I'm on page 161 under subsection B.
Mm-hmm.
Hold a minimum of a minor or minor equivalency, or have no less than 2 years scratch of documented through the other state educator license scratch teaching in the course area or field being taught. So the new sentence would be, hold a minimum of a minor or minor equivalency, or have no less than 2 years documented through the other state educator license in the course area or field being taught. Does that make sense?
I would think maybe if you'd add the word experience after years, because 2 years what? You know, I think you're, well, then I think it would read.
We can do that. Mr. Chairman?
Senator City.
Thank you, and Ms. Welk, I was thinking even just moving the word teaching up and put it right after documented. No less than 2 years of documented teaching through the other state educator license in the course area or field being taught.
Mr. Chairman, it always helps to have an English teacher.
So you want to repeat that for us, Senator?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just take the word teaching and move it up after documented. And then the same thing, of course, goes on page 163 at the bottom, two lines from the bottom.
Okay, 163.
Yeah, just move teaching after documented.
Before documented.
No, documented teaching.
Oh, documented teaching.
Two is documented teaching.
Representative Munson.
Mr. Chairman, I thought one of the things you wanted to get away from was that they actually had to have experience, or was that in a different section? Where they had to be licensed, but they didn't actually have to have the job of teaching.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Munson, we probably won't document. We'll look at the license, but we're not going to call the state of California and say, was this person actually teaching? We'll assume that if it's on their license, they could have been. But basically what it means is if it's on the license, they're allowed to in that state, and so we would accept them as...
And that was why I was thinking earlier, I know Senator Citi was out of the room mm-hmm. for your testimony earlier, but mm-hmm. that's why I was thinking that a documented licensure, perhaps instead of teaching, might make more sense. Okay. So if we change that to licensure, I still don't think it solves that sentence on 163. I think it may on 161. Senator Anders.
Mr. Chairman, would it make sense, and Janet, would it make sense to use the term documented licensure and then strike the words educator license? Mm-hmm. So it says mm-hmm. 2 years of documented licensure through the other state, teaching in the course area or field being taught.
Also helps to have a journalist on
the word strike mm-hmm. too, and I think it begins to make sense if that's what you're trying to say.
I think that would be fine, Mr. Chairman.
So that would read,
Senator Andrews.
So that would read on 163, the applicant must have proficiency and hold minimum qualifications of a content area bachelor's degree in the content area to be assigned, or have no less than 2 years of documented licensure by the other state, teaching in the content area to be assigned, and have completed the Praxis 1, Praxis 2, etc. Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that sounds great to me, except for... through the other state, teaching in the court, because haven't we taken it back to requiring the teaching experience rather than a license at that point? But shouldn't we strike just teaching and leave it, what you said, just strike teaching?
I think, because you wanted the teaching experience in the first one but not in the second?
Mr. Chairman, I'd rather not have it in either.
Okay.
Well.
So then, in the first one, if you add licensure on page 161, if you add licensure after documented and scratch teaching, I think you've accomplished it there. On the second one, if you add licensure after documented and do what Senator Andrus suggested, a comma after state, but strike education license teaching, and then you'd have by the other state in the content area to be assigned. Yeah. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think on page 161, you could do this, you can get this three ways. By having no less than 2 years of licensure documented through the other state educator licensure place, by teaching in the course area, or by teaching in the field being taught. Is that what you wanted to say? That you can either be licensed for 2 years, or if you didn't...
If you don't mind, wait just a second.
No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Munson, this has to be based on that license, the other state license. I don't want someone coming to North Dakota saying, well, I taught, because in private schools in other states, they're not licensed.
So really, Mr. Chairman, and Janet, you want only one criteria then, that they held a documented license from the other state.
Right. Yeah.
if we say it that way, then.
So I think the wording we just described will accomplish that.
I'm not so sure.
We would need a motion to adopt that.
Well, I'd like to hear it again.
Okay, it would read, on 161, we'll be quick here. I know the senators need to leave here for caucus. We'll be quick. But I'd like you to hang on for a, well, you too, I'd like you to hang on for a vote here on a couple of things. Hold a minimum of a minor equivalency or have no less than 2 years of documented licensure through the other state educator license in the course area or field being taught. Want to hold it over?
The last part again.
It's not.
I've got so much stuff in mind, I can't take it.
Want to move that?
Mr. Chairman, I move we hold over the education standards and practices rules.
And it's a, is there a second?
Second.
All right, second, moved and seconded. They're still in effect because you have the emergency rule. We can just wordsmith it at the next meeting. All right.
Are you going to get trouble with the 180 days?
Mr. Chairman, when would the next meeting be?
3 months.
June.
And we've had these rules since August.
Well, we're probably already in trouble with 180. No, we're close.
So, Counselor, what's your...
If you get a reading of the statute...
While he's doing that, let's...
Oh, we're reading that, Mr. Yeah. Chairman.
Yes.
If I may, I'll move that we hold over the years for integrated health care.
Is there a second? Just to be able to review them and visit with them about what they're doing, because it's a new area of...
No, yeah.
We're jumping two different things here.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I guess being new, I'm misunderstanding what he was doing because the music therapy I have some connection to, and that's why I was so interested. I started immediately reading that section,
right.
And you know, I noticed
effect,
it was in there.
The effect of holding them over, they're practicing right now. They're doing their thing under the statute. It would simply allow the committee another opportunity to read those and work with them on them if we have any.
No, I'm fine. I thought he was asking for approval.
No.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear.
No, they're automatically approved if we take no action.
Because I want to review them.
Is that a second?
Yes, a second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. Discussion. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll resist it. I think they've done everything we asked them to do. We spent a lot of time with this bill in the last session in the Human Service Committee, trying to come up with a way for some of these small professional boards to go through their licensure, and I think this was a proper way to do it. They've involved the Attorney General. They've done everything they should do. We may have some questions on the rules down the road. We have questions on all the rules down the road. I don't think we have to hold over this set of rules for any reason, so I will oppose it.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Representative Devlin. I was the prime sponsor on this bill. We worked extensively on this bill through many amendments last session, and I feel that they have fulfilled exactly what we had hoped to do.
And you thoroughly examined the rules. What I was saying earlier, it might have been again before you were back in the room, but is that I have not had the opportunity to really review them like I'd like, and I suspected that might be true more of the committee because we're in the middle of a session. That was my main reason for wanting to do that, but it's at the will of the committee. So, further discussion. Seeing none, we'll ask the council to call the roll on the motion to hold over the rules for the, get the terminology correct here, the Board of Integrative Health Care, I guess that's what it's called, Integrative Health Care.
Okay, Representative Koppelman.
Yes.
Representative Armament.
No.
Representative Binning, Representative Devlin.
No.
Representative Franzbach.
No.
Representative Munson.
No.
Representative Owens.
Yes.
Representative Schatz. Representative Thorson. Senator Andrews.
Yes.
Senator Heckerman.
No.
Senator Hogue. Senator Klein. Senator City.
No.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Motion fails, I'm not sure.
6 nay and 3 yeah.
All right, motion, we have a quorum?
Yes,
still good to go. Okay.
I locked the door.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, what is the verdict on standards of practices?
Was
the 180.
Yeah.
If we do nothing I don't know if we can do anything unless we agree on something right now, because 180 days might be done.
Here we go. Where is the effective date? What is the declared effective date of the emergency rules, Jan?
August 14th.
All right.
I don't think it's when the rule takes effect, it's when the agency adopts it as a final rule, which they have now done.
So you've made a motion, or do you want to make your motion again, so we're
clear? Yes, I move that we hold over the rules for Education Standards and Practices Board.
And we had a second, I believe. Second here. Ask the clerk to call the roll.
Who was the second there?
Representative Owens.
Okay. Let's see. Representative Goblin.
Yes.
Representative Hammerman.
Yes.
Representative Devlin.
Yes.
Representative Fassbach.
Yes.
Representative Munson.
Yeah.
And Representative Owens.
Yes.
Representative Johnson, Dorson. No. Senator Andrews.
Yes.
Senator Heckerman.
Yes.
Senator Hogue, Senator Klein, Senator Sieg.
Yes.
Yeah, that carries, Mr. Chairman.
Motion carries, and we adjourn. Committee, thank you for your hard work.
We appear to be-